cousins. It seemed unlikely she would grant me a visit, but a week before her labor began, she allowed me in to see her. It was a frosty morning in February. The sky was bunched with winter clouds, and the fireplaces throughout the house crackled and hissed. In the withdrawing room, the fire provided the only light. Mother, who was a week from her 40th birthday, was sprawled on her recamier, looking perfectly miserable. "I hope you have no trouble to speak of, for I have no strength to deal with it," she said through swollen lips. "I have a request." She raised herself slightly and reached for her cup on the tea table. "Well then, what is it? What is this request that cannot wait?" I'd come prepared with a speech, feeling resolute, but now my head swam with anxiety. I closed my eyes and wondered how I could make her understand. "I'm afraid you'll refuse me without thought. For heaven's sake, why should I do that? Because my wish is out of the ordinary. I wish to be godmother to the new baby." "Well, you're correct. It's out of the ordinary. It's also out of the question." I'd expected this. I knelt beside her. "Mother, if I have to beg, I will. I've lost everything precious to me. What I thought to be the purpose of my life. My hope for an education, books, Thomas. Even father seems lost to me now. Don't deny me this, please."
"But Sarah, the baby's godmother? Of all things. It's not some frippery. The religious welfare of the child would be in your hands. You're 12. What would people say?"
I'll make the child the purpose of my life. You said I must give up ambition. Surely the love and care of a child is something you can sanction. Please, if you love me."
Lowering my head to her lap, I cried the tears I'd not been able to cry the night of Thomas's farewell, or since. Her hand cupped the back of my head, and when I finally composed myself, I saw that her eyes were moist.
"All right, then. You'll be the baby's godmother, but see to it you do not fail him."
I kissed her hand and slipped from the room, feeling, oddly, that I'd reclaimed a lost part of myself.
Handful. I twined red thread round the trunk of the spreading tree till every last bit had come off the spool. Mama watched. It was all me and my idea to make us a spirit tree like Mama had made. And I could tell she was just humoring. She clutched her elbows and blew fog with her breath. She said, "You about got it. It's cold as the blue moon out here." It was cold as Charleston could get. Sleet on the windows, blankets on the horses, Sabi and Prince chopping firewood daylight to dark. I gave Mama a look and spread my red and black quilt on the ground. It made a bright spot laying under the bare limbs. I said, "First we got to kneel on this and give our spirits to the tree. I want us to do it the way you said Granny Mama did." She said, "All right, let's do it then." We dropped on our knees and stared at the tree trunk with our coat sleeves touching. The ground was hard-caked, covered with acorns, and the cold seeped through the squares and triangles. A quietness came down on us, and I closed my eyes. Inside my coat pocket, my fingertips stroked Miss Sarah's silver button. It felt like a lump of ice. I'd plucked it from the ash can after she cast it off. I felt bad she had to give up her plan, but that didn't mean you throw out a perfect good button. Mama shifted her knees on the quilt. She wanted to make the spirit tree quick, and I wanted to make the minutes last. I said, "Tell it again how you and Granny Mama did it." "All right. What we did was get down like this on the quilt, and she say, Now we putting our spirits in the tree so they safe from harm, so they live with the birds learning to fly. Then we just give our spirits to it. Did you feel it when it happened? She pulled her headscarf over her cold ears and tried to bottle up her smile. She said, let me see if I can remember. Yeah, I felt my spirit leave from right here. She touched the bone between her breasts. It leave like a little draft of wind, and I look up at a branch and I don't see it, but I know my spirit's up there watching me. She was making all this up. It didn't matter, because I didn't see why it couldn't happen that way now. I called out, I give my spirit to the tree. Mama called out the same way. Then she said, after your granny mama make our spirit tree, she say, if you leave this place, you go get your spirit and take it with you. Then she pick up acorns, twigs, and leaves and make pouches for him, and we wear them round our neck. So me and mama picked up acorns and twigs and yellow crumbles of leaves. The whole time I thought about the day Mrs. gave me as a present to Miss Sarah, how Mama told me, he gonna be hard from here on, Tanful. Since that day, a year passed, I got myself a friend in Miss Sarah and found how to read and write. But it'd been a heartless road, like Mama said, and I didn't know what would come of us. We might stay here the rest of our lives with the sky slammed shut, but Mama had found the part of herself that refused to bow and scrape. And once you find that, you got trouble breathing on your neck.
Part 2. February 1811 through December 1812. Sarah. Sitting before the mirror in my room, I stared at my face while Handful and 6-year-old Nina wove my ponytail into braids, with the aim of looping them into a circlet at the nape of my neck. Earlier, I'd rubbed my face with salt and lemon vinegar, which was Mother's formula for removing ink spots. It had lightened my freckles, but not erased them, and I reached for the powder muff to finish them off. It was February, the height of Charleston's social season, and all week, a stream of calling cards and invitations had collected on the waiting desk beside the front door. From them, Mother had chosen the most elegant and opportune affairs. Tonight, a waltzing party. I'd entered society 2 years ago, at 16, thrust into the lavish round of balls, teas, musical salons, horse races, and picnics, which, according to Mother, meant the dazzling doors of Charleston had flung open and female life could begin in earnest. In other words, I could take up the business of procuring a husband. How high-born and moneyed this husband turned out to be would depend entirely on the allure of my face, the delicacy of my physique, the skill of my seamstress, and the charisma of my tête-à-tête. Notwithstanding my seamstress, I arrived at the glittery entrance like a lamb to slaughter. "Look at this mess you've gone and made," Handful said to Nina, who'd tangled the lock of hair assigned to her into what we commonly referred to as a rat's nest. Handful raked the brush through it at no small expense to my scalp, then divided the strands into 3 even pieces, and pronounced 2 of them to be rabbits and 1 of them a log. Nina, who'd gone into a pout at having her braid confiscated, perked up at the prospect of a game. "Watch now," Handful told her. "This rabbit goes under the log, and this rabbit goes over the log. You make them hop like that all the way down. See, that's how you make a plate. Hop over, hop under." Nina took possession of the rabbits and the log and created a remarkably passable braid. Handful and I oohed and awed as if she'd carved a Florentine statue. It was a winter evening like so many others that passed in quiet predictability. The room flushed with lamplight, a fire nesting on the grate, an early dark flattening against the windows, while my 2 companions fussed over me at the dresser. My sister and godchild, Angelina, Nina for short, already bore the oval face and graceful features with which our older sister Mary had been blessed. Her eyes were brown,
and her hair and lashes dark as the little stone box in which I'd once kept my button. My precious Nina was strikingly beautiful. Better yet, she had a lively intellect and showed signs of being quite fearless. She believed she could do anything, a condition I took pains to foster, despite the disaster that had come from my own fearless believing. My aspiration to become a jurist had been laid to rest in the graveyard of failed hopes, an all-female establishment. The sorrow of it had faded, but regret remained, and I'd taken to wondering if the fates might be kinder to a different girl. Throughout my childhood, a framed sketch of the three fates had hung prominently at the top of the stairs, where they went about their business of spinning, measuring, and cutting the thread of life, all the while keeping an eye on my comings and goings. I was convinced of their personal animosity toward me, but that didn't mean they would treat my sister's thread the same way. I'd vowed to Mother that Nina would become the purpose of my life, and so she was. In her, I had a voice that didn't stammer, and a heart that was unscathed. It's true, I lived a portion of my life through hers, and yes, I blurred the lines of self for both of us. But there was no one who loved Nina more than I did. She became my salvation, and I want to think I became hers. She'd called me Mother from the time she could talk. It came naturally, and I didn't discourage it. But I did have the good sense to keep her from doing it in front of Mother. From the days Nina was in her crib, I'd proselytized her about the evils of slavery. I'd taught her everything I knew and believed, and though Mother must have had some idea I was molding her in my own image, she had no idea to what extent. With her braid complete, Nina climbed into my lap and began her usual pleading.
"Don't go. Stay with me."
"Oh, I have to. You know that. Benna will tuck you in." Nina's lip fluted out, and I added, "If you don't whine, I'll let you pick out the dress I wear." She fairly leapt from my knees to the wardrobe, where she chose the most luxuriant costume I had, a maroon velvet gown with three satin chevrons down the front, each with an agraff of chipped diamonds. It was Handful's own magnificent creation. At 17, she was a prodigy with the needle, even more so than her mother. She now sewed most of my attire. As Handful stretched on tiptoe to retrieve the dress, I noticed how undeveloped she was, her body lithe and skinny as a boy's. She didn't reach 5 feet and never would. But as small as she was, it was still her eyes that drew attention. I'd once heard a friend of Thomas's refer to her as the pretty, yellow-eyed negress. We weren't as close as we'd been as girls. Perhaps it was due to my absorption with Nina, or to Handful's extra duties as the apprentice seamstress. Or maybe we'd simply reached an age when our paths naturally began to diverge. But we were friends, I told myself. As she passed the fireplace with the dress in her arms, I noticed the frown that seemed permanently etched in her features, as if by narrowing her enormous eyes, she felt less of the world could reach her. It seemed she'd begun to feel the boundaries of her life more keenly, that she'd arrived at some moment of reckoning. The past week, Mother had denied her a pass to the market for some minor, forgettable reason, and she'd taken it hard. Her market excursions were the acme of her days, and, trying to commiserate, I'd said, "I'm sorry, Handful. I know how you must feel." It seemed to me I did know what it felt to have one's liberty curtailed, but she blazed up at me. "So we just the same, me and you? That's why you the one to shit in the pot, and I'm the one to empty it?" Her words stunned me, and I turned toward the window to hide my hurt. I heard her breathing in fury before she fled the room, not to return the rest of the day. We hadn't spoken of it again. She helped me now step into the gown and slide it over my corset, which I'd laced as loosely as possible. I was of average build and didn't think it necessary to obstruct my breathing. After fastening me in, Handful pinned a black mantilla of peau de soie to the crown of my head, and Nina handed me my black lace fan. Flicking it open, I swanned about the room for them. Mother entered at the moment I pirouetted, trampling on my hemline and pitching forward, the picture of grace.
"I hope you can refrain from this kind of clumsiness at Mrs. Alston's," she said.
She stood, buttressed by her cane. At 46, her shoulders were already rounding into an old lady's stoop. She'd been warning me of the travail of spinsterhood for a year now, elaborating on the sad maiden life of her Aunt Amelia Jane. She likened her to a shriveled flower pressed between the pages of a forgotten book, as if this might scare some poise and beauty into me. I feared that Mother was about to embark again on her aunt's desiccated existence, but she asked,
"Didn't you wear this gown only 2 nights ago?
"I did, but..." I looked at my baby sister perched on the dresser stool and gave her a smile. "Nina chose it."
"It's imprudent to wear it again so soon."
Mother seemed to be speaking solely to herself, and I took the opportunity to ignore her. Her gaze fell on Angelina, her last child. She made a summoning gesture, her hand scooping at the air for several seconds before she spoke.
"Come along. I will see you to the nursery."
Nina didn't move. Her eyes turned to me, as if I were the higher authority and might override the command. It was not lost on Mother.
"Angelina, I said come, now!"
If I'd been a thorn in Mother's side, Angelina would be the whole briar patch. She shook her head, as well as her shoulders. Her entire frame oscillated defiantly on the stool. And knowing very well what she was doing, she announced,
"I want to stay here with Mother."
I braced for Mother's outburst, but it didn't come. She pushed her fingers into her temples, moved them in a circle, and made a sound that was part groan, part sigh, part accusation.
"I've been seized by a malicious headache," she said. "Hetty, fetch Cindy to my chamber."
With a roll of her eyes, Handful obeyed, and Mother departed after her, the dull tap of her cane receding along the corridor. I knelt before Nina, sinking down into my skirt, which billowed out in such a way I must have appeared like a stamen in some monstrous red bloom.
"How often have I told you? You mustn't call me Mother unless we're alone."
Nina's chin trembled visibly.
"But you're my mother."
I let her cry into the velvet of my dress.
"You are, you are, you are."
The upstairs drawing room in Mrs. Alston's house on King Street was lit to an excessive brightness by a crystal chandelier that blazed like a small inferno from the ceiling. Beneath it, a sea of people danced the schottische, their laughter drowning out the violins. My dance program was bare except for Thomas, who'd written in his name for 2 sets of the quadrille. He'd been admitted to the bar the year before and opened a practice with Mr. Langdon Chevs, a man I couldn't help but feel had taken my place, just as I had taken Mother's. Thomas had written to me from Yale, remorseful for ridiculing my ambition on the night of his farewell, but he wouldn't budge from his position. We'd made peace, nevertheless, and in many ways he was still a demigod to me. I looked about the room for him, knowing he would be attached to Sally Drayton, whom he was soon to marry. At their engagement party, Father had declared that a marriage between a Grimke and a Drayton would bring forth a new Charleston dynasty. It had irked Mary, who'd entered into a suitable engagement herself, but one without any regal connections. Madame Ruffin had suggested I use my fan to advantage, concealing my strong jaw and ruddy cheeks, and I did so obsessively out of self-consciousness. Positioning the fan over the lower half of my face, I peered over its scalloped edge. I knew many of the young women from Madame Ruffin's classes, St. Philip's, or the previous social season, but I couldn't claim a friendship with any of them. They were polite enough to me, but I was never allowed into the warmth of their secrets and gossip. I think my stammer made them uneasy. That and the awkwardness I seemed to feel in their presence. They were wearing a new style of head turban the size of settee cushions, made from heavy brocades and studded with pins, pearls, and little palettes on which the face of our new president, Mr. Madison, was painted. And their poor heads appeared to wobble on their necks. I thought they looked silly, but the beaux swarmed about them. Night after night, I endured these grand affairs alone, revolted by what objet d'art we were, and contemptuous of how hollow society had turned out to be. And yet, inexplicably, I was filled with a yearning to be one of them. The slaves moved among us with trays of custard and Huguenot torts, holding doors, taking coats, stoking fires, moving without being seen. And I thought how odd it was that no one ever spoke of them, how the word slavery was not suitable in polite company, but referred to as the peculiar institution. Turning abruptly to leave the room, I plowed headlong into a male slave carrying a crystal pitcher of dragoon punch. It created a magnificent explosion of tea, whiskey, rum, cherries, orange slices, lemon wedges, and shards of glass. They spilled across the rug, onto the slave's frock coat, the front of my skirt, and the trousers of a tall young man who was passing by at the moment of collision. In those first seconds of shock, the young man held my gaze, and I reflexively lifted my hand to my chin as if to cover it with my fan, then realized I had dropped my fan in the commotion. He smiled at me as sound rushed back into the room, gasps and thin cries of alarm. His composure calmed me, and I smiled back, noticing he had a tiny polyp of orange pulp on his cheek. Mrs. Alston appeared in a swishing, silver-gray dress, her head bare except for a small jeweled headband across her curling bangs. With aplomb, she inquired if anyone had suffered injury. She dismissed the petrified slave with her hand and summoned another to clean the wreckage, all the while laughing softly to put everyone at ease. Before I could make an apology, the young man spoke loudly, addressing the room.
"I beg your forgiveness. I fear I am an awkward lout."
"But it was not you," I began. He cut me off.
"The fault is completely mine."
"I insist you think no more of it," Mrs. Austin said. "Come, both of you, and we'll get you dried off." She escorted us to her own chamber and left us in the care of her maid, who dabbed at my dress with a towel. The young man waited, and without thinking, I reached out and brushed the pulp from his cheek. It was overly forward of me, but I wouldn't consider that until later.
"We make a drowned pair," he said. "May I introduce myself? I'm Burke Williams."
"Sarah Grimke." The only gentleman who'd ever shown interest in me was an unattractive fellow with a bulging forehead and raisin eyes. A member of the jockey club, he'd escorted me about the Newmarket course at the culmination of race week last year, and afterward deposited me in the ladies' stand to watch the horses on my own. I never saw him again. Mr. Williams took the towel and blotted his pants, then asked if I would like some air. I nodded, dazed that he'd asked. His hair was blonde, mottled with brown, something like the light sands on the beach at Sullivan's Island. His eyes were greenish, his chin broad, and his cheeks faintly chiseled. I became aware of myself staring at him as we strolled toward the balcony off the drawing room, behaving like a fool of a girl, which of course I was. He was aware of it. I saw a smile pull about his mouth, and I silently berated myself for my transparency, for losing my precious fan, for slipping into the solitary darkness of the balcony with a stranger. What was I doing? The night was cold. We stood by the railing, which had been festooned with pine wreaths, and stared at the figures moving past the windows inside the room. The music whirred behind the panes. I felt very far away from everything. The sea wind rose and I began to shiver. My stammer had been in hibernation for almost a year, but last winter it had showed up on the eve of my coming out and remained throughout my first season, turning it into a perdition. I shook now as much from fear of its return as from the frigid air.
"You're chilled," he said,
removing his coat and draping it about me in gentlemanly fashion.
"How is it we've not been introduced until now?"
"Williams." I didn't recognize his family name. Charleston's social pyramid was ruthlessly defended by the aristocratic planters at the top. The Middletons, Pinckneys, Haywards, Draytons, Smiths, Manigaults, Russells, Alstons, Grimkeys, and so on. Below them dwelled the mercantile class, wherein a little social mobility was sometimes possible. And it occurred to me that Mr. Williams was from this secondary tier, having slipped into society through an opportune crevice, or perhaps he was a visitor to the city.
"Are you visiting here?"
I asked.
"Not at all. My family's home is on Van Drost. But I can read your thoughts. You're trying to place my family."
"Williams, Williams, wherefore art thou Williams?"
He laughed.
"If you're like the others, you're worried I'm an artisan or a laborer, or worse, an aspirer."
I caught my breath.
"Oh, I didn't mean, I'm not concerned with that sort of thing." "It's all in jest. I can see you're not like the others. Unless, of course, you're off-put to learn my family runs the silversmith shop on Queen Street. I'll inherit it one day."
"I'm not off-put. I'm not at all," I said, then added, "I've been in your shop." I didn't say that shopping for silver irked me no end, as did most everything I was forced to do as a wife in training. Oh, the days Mother had forced me to hand Nina over to Binna and sit with Mary, doing handwork samplers, hoop after hoop of white on white, cross-stitch and crewel. And if not handwork, then painting. And if not painting, then visitations. And if not visitations, then shopping in the somber shops of silversmiths, where my mother and sister swooned over a sterling nutmeg grater or some such. I'd fallen silent, uneasy with where our conversation had led, and I turned toward the garden, looking down into the faded black shadows. The pear trees were bare, their limbs spread open like the viscera of a parasol. Stretching into the darkness beyond, the single houses, double houses, and villas were lined up in cramped, neat rows which ran toward the tip of the peninsula.
"I see I have offended you," he said. "I intended to be charming, but I've been mocking instead. It's because my station is an awkward topic for me. I'm ill at ease with it."
I turned back to him, astonished that he'd been so free with his thoughts. I hadn't known a young man to display this kind of vulnerability.
"I'm not offended, I'm charmed, like you said."
"I thank you, then."
"No, I should be the one to thank you. The clumsiness in the drawing room, that was mine. And you—"
"I could claim I was trying to be gallant, but in truth, I wanted to impress you. I've been watching you. I was about to introduce myself when you whirled about and it rained punch."
I laughed, more startled than amused. Young men did not watch me.
"You created a brilliant spectacle," he was saying. "Don't you think?"
Regrettably, we were veering into the hazards of flirting. I'd always been feeble at it.
"Yes, I try."
"And do you create these spectacles often?" he asked.
"I try."
"You've succeeded well. The ladies on the dance floor recoiled with such shock I thought a turban might sail off and injure someone."
"Ah, but the injury would have been laid at your feet, not mine. I mean, it was you who claimed responsibility for the whole thing."
Where had that come from?
He bowed, conceding.
"We should return to the party," I told him, peeling his coat from my shoulders, wanting to end the banter on a high note, but worried, too, we might be missed.
"If you insist, but I would rather not share you. You're the loveliest lady I've met this season."
His words seemed gratuitous, and for an instant I didn't quite trust them. But why couldn't I be lovely to him? Perhaps the fates at the top of the stairs had changed their minds. Perhaps he'd looked past my plainness and glimpsed something deeper. Or perhaps I was not as plain as I thought.
"May I call on you?" he asked.
"You want to call on me?" He reached for my hand and pulled it to his lips. He kissed it, not removing his eyes from mine, pressing the heat and smoothness of his lips onto my skin. His face seemed strangely concentrated, and I felt the warmth from his mouth move up my arm into my chest.
Handful. The day Mama started sewing her story quilt, we were sitting out by the spirit tree doing handwork. We always did the trouble-free work there, hems, buttons, and trimmings, or the tiny stitches that strained your eyes in a poor-lit room. The minute the weather turned fair, we'd spread a quilt on the ground and go to town with our needles. Mrs. didn't like it. She said the garments would get soiled. Mama told her, "Well, I need the outdoor air to keep going, but I'll try and do without it." Right after that, Mama's quota fell off. Nobody was getting much of anything new to wear, so Mrs. said, "All right then, sew outside, but see to it my fabrics stay clean." It was early in the springtime, and the tree buds were popping open while we sat there. Those days, I did a lot of fretting and fraying. I was watching Miss Sarah in society, how she wore her finery and going whichever way she pleased. She was wanting to get a husband soon and leave. The world was a Wilton carpet stretched out for her, and it seemed like the doors had shut on me. And that's not even right. The doors never had opened in the first place. I was getting old enough to see they never would. Mrs. was still dragging us into the dining room for devotions, preaching, "Be content with your lot, for this is of the Lord." I wanted to say, "Take your lot and put it where the sun don't shine." The other thing was little Nina. She was Miss Sarah's own sister, more like a daughter to her. I loved Nina too. You couldn't help it. But she took over Miss Sarah's heart. That's how it should be, but it left a hole in mine. That day by the tree, me and Mama had the whole kit and kumbuttle of our sewing stuff lined up on the tree roots. Threads, needle bags, pin cushions, shears, and a small tin of beeswax we used to grease our needles. A wax needle would almost glide through the cloth by itself, and I got where I hated to sew without the smell of it. I had the brass thimble on my finger, finishing up a dressing table cover for Mrs. Bedchamber, embroidering it with some scuppernong vines going round the edges. Mama said I'd outshined her with my sewing. I didn't use a tracing wheel like her, and my darts lay perfect every time. Back 2 years when I turned 15, Mrs. said, "I'm making you our apprentice seamstress, Hetty. You ought to learn all you can and share in the work." I'd been learning from Mama since I could hold a needle, but I guess this made me official, and it spread some of the burden off Mama over to me. Mama had her wooden patch box beside her, plus a stack of red and brown quilt squares fresh cut. She rooted through the box and came up with a scrap of black cloth. I watched her cut three figures purely by eye. No hesitation, that's the trick. She pinned the shapes on a red square and started appliquing. She sat with her back rounded, her legs straight out, her hands moving like music against her chest. When we'd made our spirit tree, I'd sewed a pouch for each of us out of old bed ticking. I could see hers peeking out from her dress collar, plumped with little pieces of the tree. I reached up and gave mine a pat. Beside the tree charms, mine had Miss Sarah's button inside it. I said, "So what kind of quilt you making?" "This is a story quilt," she said, and that was the first time I heard of one. She said her mama made one, and her mama before her. All her kin in Africa, the Fon people, kept their history on a quilt. I left off my embroidery and studied the figures she was sewing. A man, a woman, and a little girl between them. They would join at the hands. Who were they supposed to be? When I get it all done, I tell you the story square by square. She grinned, showing the big space between her teeth. After she stitched on the three people, she free-cut a tiny quilt top with black triangles and sewed it at the girl's feet. She cut out little shackles and chains for their legs, then a host of stars that she sewed all around them. Some stars had tails of light, some lay on the ground. It was the story of the night her mama, my granny mama, got sold and the stars fell. Mama worked in a rush, needing to get the story told, but the more she cut and stitched, the sadder her face turned. After a while, her fingers slowed down, and she put the quilt square away. She said, "This gonna take a while, I guess." Then she picked up a half-done quilt with a flower applique. It was milk white and rose pink. Something sure to sell. She worked on it lackluster. The sun guttered in the leaves over our heads, and I watched the shadows pass over her. For the sake of some gossip, I told her, "Miss Sarah met a boy at one of her parties, and he's all she wants to talk about." "I got somebody like that," she said. I looked at her like her head had fallen off. I set down the embroidery hoop, and the white dresser cover flopped in the dirt. "Well, who is he? Where'd you get him?" "Next trip to the market, I'll take you to see him. All I gonna say is, he a free black, and he one of a kind." I didn't like she'd been keeping things from me. I snapped at her, "And you gonna marry Mr. One of a Kind Free Black?" "No, I ain't. He already married." "Course he was." Mama waded through my peak, then said, "He come into some money and bought his own freedom. He cost a fortune, but his master have a gamble debt, so he only paid $500 for himself. And he still have money after that to buy a house at 20 Bull Street. It sit 3 blocks from where the governor live." "How'd he get all this money?" "Won it in the East Bay Street lottery." I laughed out loud. "That's what he told you? Well, I reckon this is the luckiest slave that ever lived." "It happened 10 years ago. Everybody know about it. He buy a ticket and his number come up. It happened." The lottery office was down the street from the market, near the docks. I passed it myself when Mama took me out to learn the shopping. There was always a mishmash of people getting tickets. Ship captains, city guard, white laborers, free blacks, slaves, mulattoes, and Creoles. There'd be 2-3 men in silk cravats with their carriages waiting. I said, "How come you don't buy a ticket and waste a coin on some fancy chance?" For the last 5 years, every lick of strength Mama had left from sewing for Mrs. had gone toward her dollar bill collection. She'd been hired out steady since I was 11, but it wasn't on the sly anymore. And thank you, kind Jesus, for that. Her counterfeit badge and all that sneaking out she'd done for the better part of a year had put white hair on my head. I used to pull it out and show it to her. I'd say, "Look what you're doing to me." She'd say, "Here I is, saving up to buy us freedom, and you worrying about hair." When I was 13, Mrs. had finally given in and let Mama hire out. I don't know why. Maybe she got tired of saying the word no. Maybe it was the money she wanted. Mama could put $100 a year in Mrs.'s pocket. But I know this much. It didn't hurt when Mama made Mrs. a patchwork quilt for Christmas that year. It had a square for each of her children made from some remnant of theirs. Mama told her, "I know this ain't nothing much, but I sold you a memory quilt of your family so you can wrap up in it after they gone." Mrs. touched each square. "Why, this is from the dress Mary wore to her coming out. And this is Charles' baptism blanket. My goodness, this is Thomas's first riding shirt. Mama didn't waste a breath. She asked Mrs. Wright then to hire her out. A month later, she was hired legal to sew for a woman on Trad Street. Mama kept 20 cents on the dollar. The rest went to Mrs., but I knew Mama was selling underhand on the side. Frilled bonnets, quilt tops, candle wick bed covers, all sorts of wares that didn't call for a fitting. She had me count the money regular. It came to $190. I hated to tell her. Her money pot could hit the roof, but that didn't mean Mrs. would sell us, especially to ourselves. Thinking about all this, I said, we so too good for Mrs. to let us go. Well, if she refuse us, then our sewing gonna get real bad real fast. What makes you think she wouldn't sell us to somebody else for spite? Mama stopped working, and the fight seemed to almost leave her. She looked tired. It's a chance we has to take, or else we gonna end up like Snow. Poor Snow. He died one night last summer. Fell over in the privy. Aunt Sister tied his jaw to keep his spirit from leaving, and he was laid out on a cooling board in the kitchen house for 2 days before they put him in a burial box. The man had spent his whole life carrying the Grimkes round town. Sawby took his place as the coachman, and they brought some new boy from their plantation to be the footman. His name was Goodis, and he had one lazy eye that looked sideways. He watched me so much with that eye, Mama'd say, "That boy got his heart fixed on you." I don't want him fixing his heart on me. That's good, she'd said. I can't buy nobody's freedom but mine and yours. You get a husband, and he on his own. I tied off a knot and moved the embroider hoop over, saying to myself, I don't want a husband, and don't plan on ending up like Snow on a cooling board in the kitchen house either. How much will it take to buy the both of us? I asked. Mama ran the needle in the cloth. She said, that's what you gonna find out.
Sarah. I'd never been inclined to keep a diary until I met Burke Williams. I thought by writing down my feelings, I would seize control over them, perhaps even curb what Reverend Hall called the paroxysms of carnality. For what it's worth, charting one's passion in a small daybook kept hidden in a hatbox inside a wardrobe does not subdue passion in the least. 20 February, 1811. I had imagined romantic love to be a condition of sweet utopia, not an affliction. To think, a few weeks ago, I thought my starved mind would be my worst hardship. Now my heart has its own ordeal. Mr. Williams, you torment me. It's as if I've contracted a tropical fever. I cannot say whether I wish to be cured. My diary overflowed with this sort of purple outburst. 3 March. Mr. Williams, why do you not call? It's unfair that I must wait for you to act. Why must I, as a female, be at your disposal? Why can't I send a calling note to you? Who made up these unjust rules? Men, that's who. God devised women to be the minions. Well, I quite resent it. 9 March. A month has passed, and I see now what transpired between Mr. Williams and my naive self on the balcony was a farce. He has toyed with me shamelessly. I knew it even then. He is a fickle-hearted cad, and I would no sooner speak to him now than I would speak to the devil. When I was not engaged in aerating my feelings, or caring for little Nina, or fending off mother's attempts to draw me into my dutiful female tasks, I was foraging among the invitations and calling cards left on the desk by the front door. When Nina napped in the afternoon, I had Handful wheel the copper bathtub into my room and fill it with buckets of blistering water from the laundry. This copper tub was a modern wonder, imported from France by way of Virginia, and it was the talk of Charleston. It sat on noisy little wheels and traveled room to room like a portable dipping cart. You sat in it. You did not stand over a basin and pat water on yourself. No, you were quite immersed. To top it off, one side of the tub possessed a vent that could be opened to release the used water. Mother instructed the slaves to trundle the tub onto the piazza near the rail and discharge the bathwater over the side. The waterfalls splattering into the garden alerted neighbors the hygienic Grimkes had been bathing again. When a note with scratchy penmanship arrived at the house shortly before noon on the Ides of March, I swooped upon it before Mother. 15 March. Burke Williams compliments Sarah Grimke, requesting the pleasure of her company tomorrow night. If he can serve her in any way in the meantime, he would be honored. P.S. Please excuse the borrowed paper. I stood still for several moments, then placed the note back on the pile, thinking, why should anyone care if the paper is borrowed? And then the stupefaction wore off. Caught in a sudden swell of elation, I ascended the stairs to my room, where I danced about like some tipsy bird. I'd forgotten Handful and Nina were there. They'd spread the doll tea set on the floor beneath the window, and when I turned, I saw them staring at me, holding tiny cups of pretend tea in the air.
"You must have heard from that boy,"
Handful said. She was the only one who knew of his existence.
"What boy?"
Nina asked, and I was forced to tell her about Mr. Williams, too. At this moment, Mother would be dispatching an acceptance while singing Glory Be to God in the Highest. She would be so jubilant with alleluias, it would not occur to her to wonder at his credentials.
"Will you get married like Thomas?"
Nina asked. His wedding was 2.5 months away, and a reference point for everything.
"I do believe I will,"
I told her, and the idea seemed altogether plausible. I would not be a pressed flower in a book, after all. We'd expected Mr. Williams at 8 o'clock p.m., but at 10 past, he was still absent. Mother's neck was splotched red with patches of insult, and Father, who joined Mother and me in the drawing room, held his watch in his hand. The three of us sat as if waiting for a funeral procession to pass. I feared he wouldn't appear at all, and if he did, that our visit would be cut short. By custom, the slaves' curfew, 9 o'clock in the winter, 10 o'clock in the summer, cleared gentlemen callers from the drawing rooms. When the city guard beat drums to summon the slaves off the streets, the suitors would rise en queue. He rapped on the front door at 15 past the appointed hour. When Tomfrey ushered him into the room, I lifted my fan, an extravagant nosegay of hen feathers, and my parents rose with cool civility and offered him the Duncan Fife chair that flanked the right side of the fireplace. I'd been relegated to the chair on the left, which meant we were separated by the fire screen and forced to crane our necks for a glimpse of one another. A pity. He looked more handsome than I remembered. His face had bronzed with sun, and his hair was longer, curling behind his ears. Detecting the scent of lime soap drifting from his direction, my insides convulsed involuntarily, a full-blown paroxysm of carnality. After the excuses and the trivialities, Father got right to the point.
"Tell us, Mr. Williams, what is it that your father does?"
"Sir, my father owns the silver shop on Queen Street. It was founded by my great-grandfather and is the largest silver shop in the South."
He spoke with unconcealed pride, but the stiff silence that had preceded his arrival descended again. A Grimke daughter would marry a son of the planter class who would study law, medicine, religion, or architecture in order to occupy himself until he inherited.
"A shop, you say?"
Mother asked, giving herself time to absorb the blow.
"That's correct, madam."
She turned to Father.
"A silver shop, John?"
Father nodded, and I read his thought.
"Merchant." It rose in the air above his forehead like a dark condensation.
"We've frequented the shop often," I said, beaming as if those occasions had been the highlight of my life. Mother came to my aid.
Indeed we have. It's a lovely shop, John.
Mr. Williams slid forward in his chair and addressed Father.
Sir, my grandfather's wish was to provide our city with a silver shop that would live up to the one your own grandfather, John Paul Grimke, owned. I believe it was on the corner of Queen and Meeting, wasn't it? My grandfather thought him to be the greatest silversmith in the country, greater than Mr. Revere.
Oh, the adroitness of this man! I twisted in my chair the better to see him. In the guise of a compliment, he'd let it be known he was not the only one in the room descended from the merchant class. Of course, the difference was that John Paul Grimke had parlayed the success of his shop into cotton ventures and large landholdings in the Low Country. He'd been ambitious and prudent, and toiled his way into Charleston aristocracy. Nevertheless, Mr. Williams had landed his punch. Father eyed him steadily and spoke two words.
I see.
I think he did see, too. In that moment, he saw Mr. Williams quite well. Tomfrey served Hyson tea and biscuits, and the conversation turned back to trivialities, an interlude cut short when the curfew drums began. Mr. Williams rose, and I felt a sudden deflation. To my wonder, Mother entreated him to visit again, and I saw one of Father's luxuriant eyebrows lift.
"May I see him to the door?"
I asked.
"Of course, dear, but Tomfrey will accompany you."
We trailed Tomfrey from the room, but once past the door, Mr. Williams stopped and placed his hand on my arm.
"You look enchanting,"
he whispered, drawing his face close to mine.
"It would ease my regret in leaving if you favored me with a lock of your hair."
"My hair?"
"As a token of your affection."
I lifted the hen feathers to cover the heat in my face. He pressed a white handkerchief into my hand.
"Fold the lock inside my kerchief, then toss it over the fence to George Street. I'll be there, waiting."
With that titillating directive, he gave me a grin, such a grin, and strode toward the door, where Tomfrey waited uncomfortably. Returning to the drawing room to face my parents' evaluations, I halted outside the door, realizing they were speaking about me.
"John, we must face reason. He may be her only chance."
"You think our daughter so poor a marriage prospect she can draw no better than that?"
"His family is not poor. They are reasonably well-to-do."
"But Mary, it is a mercantile family."
"The man is a suitor, and he is likely the best she can do." I fled to my room, chagrined, but too preoccupied with my clandestine mission to be wounded. Having lit the lamps and turned down the bed, Handful was bent over my desk, frowning and picking her way through the poem Leonidas, which was an almost unreadable ode to men and their wars. As always, she wore a pouch about her neck filled with bark, leaves, acorns, and other gleanings from the oak in the workyard.
"Quickly," I blurted. "Take the shears from my dresser and cut off a lock of my hair."
She squinted at me without moving a muscle.
"Why do you want to do something like that?"
"Just do it."
I was a wreck of impatience, but seeing how my tone miffed her, I explained the reason. She cut a whorl as long as my finger and watched me secret it inside the handkerchief. She followed me downstairs to the ornamental garden where I glimpsed him through the palisade fence, a shadowed figure, leaning against the stuccoed brick wall of the Dupre house across the street.
"That him?"
Handful asked. I shushed her, afraid he would hear, and then I flung the amorous bundle over the fence. It landed in the crushed shell that powdered the street. The next day, Father announced we would depart immediately for Belmont. Because of Thomas's upcoming nuptials, it had previously been decided Father would journey to the upcountry plantation alone this spring. And now suddenly the entire family was thrown into a frenzied mass exodus.
Did he think no one understood it had everything to do with the unsuitable son of a silversmith? I penned a hurried letter, which I left for Tomfrey to post. 17 March. Dear Mr. Williams, I am sorry to inform you that my family will leave Charleston in the morning. I will not return until the middle of May. Leaving in such an impromptu manner prevents me saying farewell in person, which I much regret. I hope I might welcome you again to our home on East Bay as soon as I return to civilization. I trust you found your handkerchief and its contents, and keep them close. With affectionate regards, I am Sarah Grimke. The 7 weeks of my separation from Mr. Williams were a cruel agony. I busied myself with the establishment of a slave infirmary on the plantation, installing it in a corner of the weaving house. It had once been a sick bay, years before, but had fallen into dereliction, and Peggy, the slave who did the weaving, had taken to storing her carded wool on the infirmary's old cot. Nina helped me scrub the corner and assemble an apothecary of medicine, salves, and herbs that I begged or blended myself in the kitchen house. It didn't take long for the sick and ailing to show up. So many the overseer complained to Father that my healing enterprise interfered with field production. I expected Father to shut our doors, but he left me to it, though not without instructing me on the numberless ways the slaves would abuse my efforts. It was Mother who nearly ended the operation. Upon discovering I'd spent the night in the infirmary in order to care for a 15-year-old with childbirth fever, she shut the infirmary for 2 days, before finally relenting. "Your behavior is woefully intemperate," she said, and then treading too closely to the truth, added, "I suspect it's not compassion that drives you, as much as the need to distract your mind from Mr. Williams." My afternoons were frittered away with needlework and teas, or painting landscapes with Mary, while Nina played at my feet, all of which took place in a stuffy parlor with poorly lit windows draped in velvet swags the color of Father's port. My one respite was striking out alone on a high-spirited black stallion named Hiram. The horse had been given to me when I was 14, and since he didn't fall into the category of slave owner, or handsome beau, I was left to love him without complication. Whenever I could steal away from the parlor, Hiram and I galloped at splendiferous speeds into a landscape erupting with the same intractable wildness I felt inside. The skies were bright cerulean, teeming with ferocious winds, spilling mallards and fat wood drakes from the clouds. Up and down the lanes, the fences were lit with yellow jasmine, its musk a sweet, choking smoke. I rode with the same drunk sensuality with which I had reclined in the copper tub, riding till the light smeared, returning with the falling dark. Mother allowed me to write to Mr. Williams only once. Anything more, she insisted, was woefully intemperate. I received no letter in return. Mary heard nothing from her intended either, and claimed the mail to be atrocious, therefore I didn't overly fret. But quietly and daily, I wondered whether Mr. W. and his grin would be there when I returned. I placed my hope in the bewitching properties contained in the lock of my red hair. This wasn't so different than Handful placing her faith in the bark and acorn she wore around her neck, but I wouldn't have admitted it. I'd thought little of Handful during my incarceration at Belmont, but on the day before we left, the 15-year-old slave I'd nursed appeared, cured of childbirth fever, but now with boils on her neck. Seeing her, I understood suddenly that it wasn't only miles that separated Handful and me. It wasn't any of those things I'd told myself, not my preoccupation with Nina, or Handful's duties, or the natural course of age. It was some other growing gulf, one that had been there long before I had left.
Handful. Late in the afternoon, after the Grimkes have gone off to their plantation, and the few slaves left on the premise were in their quarters, Mama sent me into Master Grimke's library to find out what me and her would sell for. She stood lookout for Tomfrey. I told her, don't worry about